Hello, everybody, and welcome again to Nerd to the Third Power, your one-stop shop for all things nerdy and awesome. I am your host and master of ceremonies, Dr. Gonzo. Kat is still taking her break as she works on Anime St. Louis. And Mike has got a prior commitment tonight, so he's also not with us tonight. But Skyblaze, you're here. How are you doing this week?
I'm not bad. Yesterday was interesting at work. Sat there minding my own business, working through my workload. All of a sudden, Sony Go, lol, PS5 is a thing. Thank you for quadrupling my workload, Sony. That's fantastic.
Oh man, yeah, it's that was a big announcement. We're still kind of over it, so we'll have to once we got some more details, we'll have to do kind of a news of the world on it. But we got a, speaking of game consoles, we got a fun discussion topic, something that I've been looking forward to and Skyblaze is looking forward to. This year, the year of our Lord 2019, marks the 20th anniversary of the Sega Dreamcast. So we thought it'd be fun to kind of look back at Sega's little white box and talk about its greater cultural impact on video game history. So, but of course, there is procedure to follow. So we're going to begin by following up on last episode's random topic of the week. And last week's topic was times that you've had to turn somebody around on your geekdom. Maybe they thought it was kind of weird or grody and you had to kind of set them straight, but now they get it. So the story that I told was of, at my mother's birthday party where my aunt told me that I would be wasting my money buying insurance for my game collection, which, to recap, it was worth about 16 grand. And my mother basically shut her down, like, no, you don't know what you're talking about. This collection is worth more than his car. So, Skyblaze, I want to put the question to you first. What's the time that you had to turn somebody around on one of your geeky hobbies? That, like, maybe they thought it was kind of a waste of time, but you said that you had to set them straight.
You mean like I did to you?
What are you referring to?
Doctor Who?
And I never thought Doctor Who was pointless or a waste of time. I just never seen it.
I remember you saying, like, I really don't get this. It's like it's some eccentric English dude wandering around in a phone box. And I and then you had to watch it for that the episode we did specifically about Doctor Who, and all of a sudden it was like, you know that scene in Blues Brothers where it's like, I have seen the light. I am on a mission from God. And you know, suddenly you came back and it was like, I have need to download all of the Big Finish episodes and buy all of the DVDs and read all of the books. It's like, okay, this is weird.
All right.
Oh, well, weird.
All right. Well, I guess I've been called to the carpet. I don't recall being hostile to the idea of Doctor Who, but I mean, now that you say it, you know, I have to admit that does sound like the kind of thing that I would have said back in the day. So okay, all right. So we got a couple stories here. First one here comes from Dragon1130. This is from the YouTube comments. He writes, I have to turn people around on my geekdom every day. I work as a janitor, currently trying to get an IT job, but you know the economy / job market. And so often I have to correct my coworkers when they act like they know what tech or anything on the internet is. I've gone on several tangents, proving to them that just because you saw something on Facebook doesn't mean you know what horrible terror the darker pits of the internet hold. On a semi-related note, Rule 34 gets brought up constantly in our discussions. Okay. Nothing here. This one comes from Biori1, and he writes, recently I was playing D&D, and on our off week, we play a Warcraft-based campaign DM'd by our Goblin Barbarian player. I play a Goblin Bard, Glamour College, and as is common with musically inclined bards, whenever I get the chance, I'd sing. Problem is that it would happen late at night over Skype, and my folks are trying to sleep upstairs, so I have to have a conversation with my mom in the morning, elaborating on exactly what I was doing. I think she gets it now, though. And this next one comes from the email, and this one comes from Sheila, and she sends what's probably my favorite story of this type. So this is the story goes, I live with my boyfriend, and one night a group of his friends were over, and they were giving him hell because on our computer desk is a topless anime figurine. And they were giving him shit, asking, you know, why do you have this here? What does your girlfriend think about this? And I chimed in from the kitchen, his girlfriend is right here, and she thinks it's fine because that figure is actually hers.
Well.
Oh. And I love stories like that, where it's like it just completely subverts the expectation of what you're expecting. So so that was our random topic last week of times you had to turn somebody around on your geekdom. And we're not going to do another random topic this week because we got some questions here for Ask a Geek that are a bit involved. So we're going to start with a pleasant one because we got one here that's going to set me off like a fucking, you know, holy terror. And the question here comes from Ray, and he asks both of us. Well, he says all of us, but it's just the two of us. So both of us. Semantics. What are our thoughts on the System Shock 3 trailer that was released a couple weeks ago? So Skyblaze, you go first. Because your answer is probably going to be a lot more healthy than mine is.
Showdown is still deeply terrifying. it looks pretty cool. But it didn't show a huge amount about the gameplay or anything. It was just a teaser trailer, so more like that would be fine.
It looks like it's borrowing more from System Shock 1 than 2. Because I saw a lot more stuff like, you know, the cyborg mutants and some enemies moving around that looked almost like the constructs from the first game.
The storytelling in 1 was a bit more even than in 2, though. So, that's okay?
I don't know.
2 had better gameplay, but the story was a bit impressive in some ways.
I don't know. I disagree. I think 2 had the better story, but that's because I like what they did to the Showdown's character in that one, because my relationship to System Shock, and more specifically to its villainous Showdown, is deeply, deeply unhealthy. Like,
yep.
I'm
can't confirm.
It's kind of one of those things where it's like, well, you know, I don't understand why anybody would be into BDSM culture. Then Showdown starts talking. I'm like, yes, give me your hate machine, mother. my relationship with this series is very unhealthy. It's but I am really excited. System Shock is one of my favorite game series of all time. Showdown is one of my favorite villainesses of all time, and I'm really looking forward to, I really hope this game gets completed, because we have heard fuck all about System Shock 3 for about 20 years. And we haven't heard anything, I think, in the last couple of years about the remake of 1 that I think it was Night Dive was working on. Have I got that right?
I can't remember.
Yeah, so
because that kind of like appeared and then disappeared completely without trace.
Yeah, so I'm hoping, like I said, I'm hoping that this actually comes to completion. And I love that they brought back Showdown's original voice actress for that trailer. So it's like that was the one key thing. Like, they didn't bring back the original voice actress, I wasn't gonna buy the game. But they brought it back, and so all is perfect, and I want it, I need it, give it to me now!
Yes, there's that, and there's Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2, which they've announced relatively recently that my... Because I know a lot of goths, okay? And I know a lot of geeks, and they cross over quite a lot. And, I mean, I showed the trailer for Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2 to my husband, and he was like, ah, I must have it right now! I was like, it doesn't come out until like next year. Not good enough.
This is England. Where's a TARDIS?
In Sheffield, probably closer than you might think.
Okay. So, all right. So that's a couple games that we're looking forward to. And let's see. Next question here. This one comes from Mark. And he asked me, but I'm going to open up to you, Skyblaze, because I'm going to need time to prepare my answer. About the announcement of the all-digital Xbox One S. So, Skyblaze, why don't you start on this one?
All-digital is one of those things that publishers really love, but retailers really despise, and customers really don't like. It's been tried before. The PSP Go, for instance, was an all-digital machine. That
failed that, worse than a Michael Bay movie.
It sank without trace. The reason that it's a problem, particularly in America, is, you know, a lot of your internet is terrible. It's overpriced, it's heavily usage capped, and this creates a huge problem for users who are trying to use digital services. I don't think publishers are going to care, and I think they're going to keep trying to push this as a thing, regardless, because they really want it, because they absolutely hate the secondhand games market. They really, really despise it. And this is a blatant attempt to murder the secondhand games market. The trouble is, it is an absolute nightmare for anything like games preservation or actually owning the shit that you buy.
And that's where I come in, because I am morally opposed to this thing. Because, I actually got an argument with a friend of mine earlier today who, he was all excited because, he's a big PC gamer. He buys all his shit on Steam. So he's all on board with a digital console. And you don't understand. Console gaming is a different beast from PC gaming, okay? I can go out today, build a brand new gaming PC from scratch, install Steam client, put in my login info, and have immediate access to all 500 of my Steam games in my Steam library, because I'm a fucking addict with no self-control every Steam sale. You can't do that with a console. So when 10, 15 years from now, the Xbox Live support for the Xbox One is shut down, and it will be. Oh yes, go ahead and ask all those Halo 2 players who were playing on the OG Xbox a few years ago. It's going to get shut down. If that console dies after that, you lose all your games. Gone, not there anymore. You. That's it. They're lost to the ether. It's planned obsolescence, and it's bullshit, and I hate it.
We've already seen this sort of thing happening with old MMOs that died. There was a big furore fairly recently with City of Heroes. Yeah. And there was a private server that they managed, because somebody managed to get hold of the netcode. Rumor has it that it was a disgruntled ex-employee handed over the netcode, and they built their own private server. But they had
on a similar note. Anybody remember WildStar?
Yep. Also, Phantasy Star Online. The only way you can play Phantasy Star Online now with the intended online functions is through private servers. And Sega have graciously looked the other way. Not every publisher and developer is happy to do that. Certainly NCSoft, who were the publisher for City of Heroes, are notoriously down on fans creating their own shit from stuff that they created, even if they're not using it. Abandonware is a popular term, but it has no legal status.
And it's especially tragic in the case of City of Heroes, because if you wind the clock back about 10, 15 years, that was a huge part of internet and gaming culture back in the day. Mm-hmm. I remember when City of Heroes came out, it was fucking everywhere. There were magazine articles about it. It was on the news. Half the webcomics that I followed at the time, were written by City of Heroes fans. So there was all kinds of, jokes and nods to the game. It was a huge part of internet of early internet and gaming culture. And now it's just gone. Not there anymore. And the Xbox One S All Digital, which I'm now realizing shortens down to Xbox One SAD, which is self-explanatory.
Thank you very much for helpfully naming your products there.
Yeah, Microsoft. It's just that abandonware it's a ticking time bomb, because like I said, once those Xbox Live servers are shut down, because they're probably going to do some bullshit where you have to have an always online connection in order to play your games.
They tried it once. The only reason that they pulled it is because they were massive rejection from the fans.
Yeah. Microsoft needs to understand that console gaming and PC gaming are two very different beasts. You can have a lot of overlap. A game that works well on a PC may work well on a console and vice versa. But as far as the nature of the beast, two entirely different markets. And you can't go treating a console market like a PC market, or else, you'll have another E3 2013. Or was it 14? Which one was it where they introduced the Xbox One and got rightfully roasted?
I can't remember. It was funny anyway.
But then
I flat refused to own a Microsoft console because I spent 8 years working in tech support. I don't give money to Microsoft. They have pissed me off too many times.
So, which is a story for another day. All right, here's a question from Reese, and he asked me how excited I am for the Borderlands 3 announcement. And I am extremely excited because Borderlands is one of my favorite game series of all time. Borderlands 2, I will still play through just for fun, and it's still an absolute blast to play. I'll tell you the thing that actually got me the most excited. It was like this little split second bit of the trailer where you saw Reese from Telltale's Tales of the Borderlands series. And I was like, yes, they're bringing those characters back. And I'm like, oh, because I love Tales from the Borderlands so much. Like, if you haven't played it and you're a Borderlands fan, you really owe it to yourself to play it. But good luck finding it now that Telltale Games has gone under. Pour one out for the, you know, for Telltale Games. Now, as far as the announcement that it's going to be an Epic Store exclusive, even though I plan on getting it on PC, I'm not really all that fussed about it, because I don't know if you follow me, for those of you who follow me on Facebook, you know, I've got a backlog of games a mile long that I need to get through. So by the time I get through those games and can play Borderlands 3, it'll already be out on Steam. So I'm not too fussed about the Epic Store exclusivity. So, which on a kind of leaping off that, Skyblaze, what are your thoughts on the whole Epic Store Steam rivalry?
I am not a big PC gamer. I have always been more of a console gamer. I play one less game on PC now, because I tripped and got Diablo 3 for Switch. So I play Diablo 3 on Switch now.
I love how you say that like it just happened by accident. Oh, I just tripped and suddenly I have Diablo 3 on Switch.
I don't know how this stuff happens. It just appears on my shelf. Whoops.
I tell you what, I'm kind of having a similar order that like a game will show up on my doorstep and I'd be like, when the fuck did I order this? Senran Kagura Peach Ball. When the hell did I order this? Oh, God. Was I drunk that night? That's a hell of a trick, considering I don't have any alcohol in my house.
Ninjas. Alcohol, yeah. Ninjas. the only way it affects me is that work is like kind of saying, oh, I guess we should probably like start a account on Epic for our stuff, because in case some codes that come through for reviews are... Yeah. On the Epic Store instead of on Steam.
The one that did hurt me was...
Frankly, out of all of them, I would rather buy stuff on GOG.
Yeah, because you don't get the DRM.
Correct.
Yeah. The one that hurt me was... The one that did hurt me, I will say this, was the exclusivity deal that did kind of wound my heart a little bit, was the Metro Last Exit announcement, because I love the Metro games. Like, oh! I want to play this, but at the same time, I've already got three different launchers on my... On my PC, all from games I purchased through Steam. Thank you, Ubisoft. I will never understand why I buy an Ubisoft game off of Steam, and then in order to play it, I have to open up another separate launcher.
Because Ubisoft hates you.
Yep. So, but they also give me Rayman, so it's a wash. All right, and that's all the Ask the Geek questions that we have for this week. Thank you, as always, for sending them to us. As always, you can send them to us through the email at drgonzo@nerdofthethirdpower.com. Get your questions in, and you might get them read on the air. And so now that we've had our vegetables, let's get to the meat of this discussion, and that's the Sega Dreamcast 20th anniversary, which is technically the 21st. It was released in Japan 21 years ago, but this is the rest of the world anniversary, because we're what's the word? Nationocentric, something like that? I don't care. Whatever. but we thought it'd be fun to kind of look at the Dreamcast and examine sort of its impact on gaming and gaming culture. And for me as a collector, I just want to say that when people ask me where I draw the line between retro gaming and modern gaming, the Dreamcast is that line. It is that point where the rules of the game changed make a very bad pun. So it's like everything that you love about modern gaming, you owe to the Sega Dreamcast. So kneel before your god, heathens.
We were having a similar discussion on Radio Sega a few years ago. We were saying a lot of the games on the Sega Dreamcast kind of like redefined the paradigms for future generations of games. I mean, things like Shenmue, which basically invented the open world game. And also establish things like what would then follow with things like the Persona series and Soul Calibur, which completely changed the rules for how 3D fighting games worked.
And then, you know, even not even just talking about the game itself, you know, just conventions of gaming as a whole, like online gaming. I mean, that was the Dreamcast was the first console to have online gaming. I mean, Phantasy Star Online. We were early in the episode, we were talking about games that, that were huge parts of early internet culture. PSO was everywhere.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was so popular that to this day there are still fan-made, fan-run private servers that you can connect to. I'll get into this later. It is still possible to connect Dreamcast to the internet.
Really?
Yes, I will get to that later.
Yeah, and it's interesting to talk about now because, again, coming from the perspective of a collector, there have been all kinds of things coming out in the last year or so to assist with Dreamcast collecting. You get the Pound HDMI cable, lets you hook your Dreamcast up to HD televisions. There's all kinds of mods and hacks now to have your Dreamcast actually put out a native HDMI signal. And there's a company, I think it's Castlemania Games, is actually putting out new Dreamcast controllers that are redesigned to be, you know, a little easier for a modern gamer who might not necessarily be used to the OG Dreamcast controller, you know, a little easier for them to use. So we figured that now would be, you know, a good time to kind of step back and take a look at Sega's little white box and how it basically completely changed the rules and also how it got totally screwed.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so let's kind of set some context here. So what was the gaming landscape like, not just as a whole, but for Sega specifically, when the Dreamcast first entered into the scene?
Well, Sega was actually in quite a lot of trouble at that point because the Sega Saturn outside of Japan had done horrendously badly. And there were also a lot of, the development of the Saturn had incurred a lot of costs, as well as the development of the 32X, which is another thing that failed. There was also a couple of consoles, the Neptune, which was supposed to be a all-in-one Sega 32X Mega CD Mega Drive unit, and that never got past the prototype stage. And there was the Pluto as well, which was supposed to be a Sega Saturn with an online mode, and that never got past prototype stage either. So they really needed a success at this point. So they kind of like looked at this and said, okay, we really need this to work. We need to reduce the costs as much as we can. So a lot of the components inside the Dreamcast were off the shelf. They were standard components. There were very little in the Dreamcast is custom build. Even amusingly, if you look at the front of a Dreamcast, you will notice that there's a little sign that says Windows CE on it.
Indeed.
That's because, yeah, it's actually capable of running Windows CE, which is Windows Compact Embedded, which is the ancestor to Windows Mobile.
Oh, wow.
Seriously.
So everything I love about modern gaming and everything I hate about modern smartphone, I also owe to the Dreamcast, because I hate Windows Mobile.
Part of the reason for Windows CE being in there was to support the online functionality, because that means it could talk to PCs and the protocols would be built in.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about the Dreamcast was that the Sega Naomi arcade board was out by this point, and considering that the Dreamcast had a lot of similarities to the Sega Naomi arcade board, that meant the ports were very easy to do. So that put them in a fairly good position, so they thought. Also, Japan was rolling out a lot of higher speed internet, so better than 56K at the rest of the world. So they thought, built-in modem, we can do that as well. So to Sega, this was, you know, pretty decent.
But it was also Hail Mary.
Yeah, it was a last-ditch attempt. It was like, if this doesn't work, we are going to have to do some serious rethinking.
Yeah, because now Sega had always performed better in the American and European markets than it had in Japan. Am I correct in that?
For the most part, yes, although not with the Saturn. The Saturn did really well in Japan and did appallingly throughout the rest of the world, mostly because of...
Bernie Stolar!
Yes, him. Stab him in the face. Let's not. No. yeah. Calm, breathe.
For those of you who are wondering, spit this name with a venom that we normally reserve for the most basest of degenerates. Bernie Stolar was basically the guy in charge of Sega of America in the later Saturn years. Which came first, his Sega tenure or his Sony tenure? Whatever, he worked for both.
It was Sony first, and Sony kicked him out, and then he went to Sega.
Yeah, and at both companies, he had this policy of no 2D games and no Japanese games. So if you've ever wondered why, when you go to a retro game store and the Sega Saturn section is all sports games, he's why. You ever wondered why?
He also attempted to block, when he was at Sony, he attempted to block Final Fantasy VII from leaving Japan.
Yeah, so that's why we hate Bernie Stolar. And while he is not the sole architect of Sega's eventual fall from grace, he definitely did a lot to set the stage for the troubles that they were having when it came time to roll out the Dreamcast.
Certainly considering that he was one of the people who was championing the 32X, which was dead on arrival, and everybody who had a brain knew it. Idiot. Yep.
So, but that's a discussion for another day. We're here to talk about a happy thing. Well, it started happy, at least.
Yeah. It's generally agreed by pretty much everybody that the Dreamcast was ahead of its time. As we've already said, most of the functionality, things like the online functionality, the idea of the lobbies for online play, originated on Dreamcast. The problem was that the world was not ready, because outside of Japan and South Korea, most of the world's internet was garbage, and was expensive garbage. Certainly in the UK, if you were online for an hour, you'd be paying, I think it's something stupid, like for an hour of internet time, you'd be paying something ridiculous like £4.
Yeah, for you young bucks out there who grew up with cable and DSL, when we were coming up, my generation, internet was through the phone, and it was actually provided by your phone company, and you were charged depending on your provider, either by the minute or by the hour of your online usage, like you would for a long distance phone call. So that's kind of why I every time I hear someone complain about how slow and bad their internet is nowadays, I just like, I become the old man. Oh, back in my day, we had to wait 15 minutes to sign on to Yahoo, and we loved it.
So sitting there waiting for several minutes, waiting for an image to load. Oh dear.
Where a 1 megabyte download took 2 years.
Yep. Oh god, we're old. Right. Yep. The problem with the Dreamcast was not only the fact that the internet functionality was not ready, but also that the PlayStation 2 came out with its vast, vast, vast library of games and its massive third-party support.
Yeah, and I think it was like 6 months after the Dreamcast was released, that was when the PS2 was first announced. And just like, it didn't even have to come out, just the fact that it was announced basically cut the legs out of the Dreamcast. Another thing that I don't see a lot of people talk about when they talk about the Dreamcast is sort of the cultural reinventing of itself that Sega went through with the Dreamcast. Because if you look at the Genesis and the Saturn, throughout the 90s, Sega had put up this very, at least in America, had put up this very rebellious, quote unquote mature vibe. Like, we're Nintendo's for kids. Where were the cool, adult gamers go? Where the rebellious teenager, the attitude era, basically. But then when you go back to the Dreamcast and look at how that was marketed, the marketing and the design of the console and its presentation, it had a very much more happy, fun feel to it, like kind of a, come one, come all, everybody, we're just going to have some fun and have a good time with it. And I think that maybe kind of it was a step that Sega kind of needed to take to distance themselves from the Saturn. But at the same time, I don't think the world really knew, at least the American market, didn't really know how to process that you went from, Sega does what Nintendo don't to, this kind of little party box, if that makes any sense.
It kind of does. The fact that the Dreamcast had four controller ports, kind of designed for party games and chilling out with the family, didn't really compute for a lot of Western gamers, because it was still largely regarded as a kid's thing. That changed with the PlayStation 2, but it didn't really change until then. So again, the Dreamcast and the Sega kind of jumped the gun a bit with that. They could see the cultural shift coming, but they got there a bit too early to catch the wave, really.
Yeah.
Where it was the PlayStation 2 that said, this is a thing for adults as well. In Japan, that was already a thing. The adults had played games for years. It was a thing that you did after work. But to Westerners, it was partially in America because of the whole like positioning the NES as a kid's toy and selling it in toy stores. It had been regarded as a child's thing.
Yeah, and so everything that came after that was tainted with original sin, as it were.
Mm. So that marketing saying, this is for everybody and families can play this together, kind of like everyone went, what? No, it's not. And that, I think that confused everyone.
So, but it also has to be pointed out that when the Dreamcast came out, it really was like, it was the first real next generation console. Like it blew everything else out of the water.
The magazines at the time were going absolutely bananas. Examining every inch of the tech specs and every concept drawing that came out for it.
Like it even made games from previous consoles like look amazing. Like one of the things that I just recently added my collection that people give me really weird looks about when I mention that I have is the Dreamcast port of Star Wars Episode I Racer, which you'll recall was originally made for the Nintendo 64, and it's a fine Nintendo 64 game. Don't get me wrong; it's an absolutely great game, a must-have for any N64 collector. But the Dreamcast version blows it completely out of the water. And the same with like the Resident Evil ports. I mean, did you know that all three of the PlayStation Resident Evil games got Dreamcast ports?
I did.
And all three of them blow the PlayStation version out of the water.
Certainly in terms of the sound quality, if you compare the soundtrack from the PlayStation version of the Resident Evil soundtrack to the Dreamcast version, the Dreamcast version is vastly superior. Sounds so much richer and clearer and CD quality as opposed to whatever MIDI. Fuck it was that, yeah.
Yeah. It also used the original Resident Evil soundtrack and not the bastardization that was in the director's cut.
I'll have to take your word for that one.
Go look up the basement theme from Resident Evil director's cut, and it can only be described as a trombone loudly refusing to consent to be played.
Well, a second. You've completely derailed my train of thought. Thanks, Gonzo.
We were talking about how the Dreamcast basically blew everything else up.
Oh, this was the era when arcade ports, like the idea of something being arcade perfect, was still a huge deal.
And actually became practical.
Yeah. Like, and the fact that the Sega Naomi board was so similar architecturally to the Dreamcast meant that could be done pretty easily.
Like this is how accurate you get. The Dreamcast port of Marvel vs. Capcom 2 is still considered the definitive cut of the game by the competitive fighting game community.
I didn't know that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, because it is so arcade perfect. There have been ports that have come out since then. There was a PlayStation 2 port, and there was a digital version released for the Xbox Live on the 360. But the Dreamcast version is still considered the final say on Marvel vs. Capcom 2.
Nice.
Just because it is so arcade perfect. So, and we also saw the birth of a lot of really popular and enduring game properties that are still going to this day, or at the very least, are still fondly remembered to this day. Like some of the ones that I can name off the top of my head. Jet Set Radio, Crazy Taxi, Legacy of Kain, technically started on the PlayStation, but the Dreamcast version of Soul Reaver is the one that everybody remembers.
Yeah. Again, it looked so good.
And Sonic Adventure. And that kind of brings me to sort of a question I want to kind of throw out, because I don't think I've ever seen a console have more of its library get ports to later systems than I've seen the Dreamcast. I think only the NES and Super Nintendo surpass it in terms of number of games in its native library that have ported to subsequent games. Like, how many different ports of Sonic Adventure 2 have there been?
Oh, God. There was the GameCube port. There's been the PC port, PS3 port, PS4 port.
There was an Xbox Live version released as well, but yeah. It's like, you know, it says something, I think, to the amount of creative talent that was in full swing at Sega at the time during the Dreamcast eras, because they were, you know, they were so desperate to make to rebuild themselves after the failure of the Saturn that they kind of just threw a bunch of the wall to see what stuck, and they hit a lot of gold mines. You know, so, you know, they're
what's really funny is that fairly recently they've announced that Space Channel 5 is getting that VR adaptation. And that came out of left field for a lot of people, because it's like, that's not been a thing for a really long time.
Yeah, I think there's 1 and 2 on the Dreamcast, and after that, Ooh La La basically made cameo appearances in, like, Sega All-Star Racing.
Mm.
You know, or Little Mac Syndrome, as it's called to Nintendo fans, after Little Mac, who from Punch Out, who had two games and then vanished. More people know Ooh La La from her cameo appearances than from Space Channel 5, which is sad, because those games are amazing.
Now, here's another thing. If you're talking about ports, at one point, Sega was actually in talks with Microsoft in regards to allowing Xbox to play Dreamcast games.
That I did not know, so you have the floor.
Uh-huh. Well, this was originally going to be a thing, and then Microsoft refused to let it happen because they wouldn't let the Dreamcast games connect to Xbox Live. Because Sega wanted the Dreamcast games to have the online capabilities like they did on the Dreamcast, and Microsoft said, no, only Xbox titles will get access to this service.
That, you know, that makes a lot of sense, because, you know, it's sort of an unspoken agreement in the retro collecting circles that the original Xbox is really sort of the spiritual successor to the Dreamcast.
In some ways it is, especially when you look at how many games that were allegedly, like, original IPs that used assets from cancelled Dreamcast games.
Oh, such as?
I can't remember the name of the game, but there is a water-based game which uses the assets that were developed for the cancelled Echo Defender of the Future sequel.
Hmm.
And I can't remember what it is, and it isn't in my notes, which is very irritating. But there's quite a few of them.
Okay. So I guess we've talked a bit about the system and its impact and how it changes the culture. So I guess we got to talk about the obvious now. Like, what are some of your favorite Dreamcast games and why? What are some ones that you just pull out to just have fun with that, you know, are still hold up to this day to you?
I still love playing Phantasy Star Online. I really, really want to set the thing up so I can actually connect to the fan servers, because that'd be awesome. I still love playing Sonic Adventure, the original Sonic Adventure and Sonic Adventure 2, even though they are clunky as hell by modern standards. they're still so much fun to play.
No comment.
Quiet you. What else? Oh, Choo Choo Rocket is great when you're having a party. Choo Choo Rocket is absolutely brilliant.
You know, I have that in my collection, but I've never been able to find anybody to play it with.
It's great. It's so much fun. Rez is superb.
Wait, that was originally on Dreamcast?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
You have learned a thing.
Yes. Now I'll have to see if I can't add it to my collection.
The original is kind of a bit of a pain to find, or at least it is here.
Let me tell you something. As a retro collector, a lot of the Dreamcast library is really hard to find because, again, it got the legs cut out under it by the Sony PlayStation. Like, the only games that are really easy to find are some of the really obvious ones, like Sonic Adventure. Shenmue is easy to find, although a bit expensive.
Shenmue 2 is quite hard to find here. It gets quite expensive.
Yeah. But if you want to get into some of like the more, you know, nitty gritty Arcana stuff, like I think my copy of Sword of the Berserk, I paid like $40 for 10 years ago. I shudder to think of what it would cost now. And that was just for a disc. I don't even have a complete in box copy. My Dreamcast collection really needs some love. The only games that I have complete in box are Shenmue, Sonic Adventure, and Episode One Racer. Everything else I just have the disc of, which really saddens me. But as far as games that I really loved on the Dreamcast, I'll still pull out Crazy Taxi and just tool around on it for a few minutes. Although I will mute the sound when I do, because I love The Offspring, one of my favorite bands, but I do not need to hear what I want every 30 goddamn seconds. So
that's fair.
Skies
of Arcadia,
which is another one I need to track down. And again, another game that got ports, because that got a GameCube port a few years later and was sold very well there. Jet Set Radio, that's another one I've been looking to get a hold of. Resident Evil Code Veronica, that was originally for the Sega Dreamcast. I remember that was there was kind of a minor fandom war in the Resident Evil community between people, you know, which was the better game, Resident Evil 3 on the PlayStation or Resident Evil Code Veronica. And you know, maybe we'll examine that dynamic another day, but that was an interesting little debate for a while. Let's see, another one that I've really enjoyed, of course I mentioned Episode One Racer, that I think that's the definitive cut of the game. But you know, and the thing about the Dreamcast library is, because it was very much like the PlayStations, that there was something for everyone on there. You know, it's not, you know, there are some consoles where genres dominate that console's library. Like, for example, the Xbox is very heavily associated with first-person shooters, and the PlayStation is very heavily associated with RPGs. Whereas the Dreamcast, you know, it was very much sort of a blank slate. It had a very varied and diverse library to it.
In Japan, there were a lot of shoot 'em ups and fighting games very, very popular on the Dreamcast.
Oh yeah, and they're still something that, if we're going to talk about, you know, about fan communities for the Dreamcast, we have to talk about the fact that the homebrew community is still going for the Dreamcast to this day. One of the retro YouTube collectors that I follow, Metal Jesus Rocks, he did a video late last year about a new shmup game that had been put out for the Dreamcast just like at the tail end of last year.
Yep.
So even 20 years on, people are still making games for this. And do you think maybe that might have something to do with the fact that because it has a Microsoft-based operating system, that it's just that easy to program for?
It's one of the reasons. One of the other reasons is that the security on it is hilariously inadequate, so it's very easy to just burn your own disk and, you know, program your own game, burn disk, put it in the machine, and it'll work.
Yeah. Although some of the later consoles that release, like I know mine actually has the firmware update where it won't play burn disks, because I've tried.
Your face.
Yeah.
Mine does.
Well, you know, I didn't buy mine until several years after petered out and I started getting into collecting.
That's fair. I think it's more of a problem in America, because the newer ones didn't really get to Europe, so it's a lot easier to find the older ones in Europe.
Yeah, it was a much bigger thing over here, because remember, at the same time as the Napster thing blew up. So it was much we got that firmware update right quick over here. I had a train of thought, but what I was gonna say, I remember now. So I guess now the question that I want to ask is, you know, is it worth collecting for the Dreamcast, you know, speaking as a collector? And I can say it certainly is, because there's a lot of really great games on that are definitely worth checking out. The one caveat that I would add is, certainly in America, collecting for the Dreamcast can get really expensive. And that's one of those things that, you know, it frustrates me, but at the same time, the reason why those games get to be higher priced is because, you know, it's because the people who have those games already are hanging on to them and playing them and not letting them go. It's not necessarily a case of something like Earthbound, where it's like, oh, we'll charge $80 for this game because we know people will play it. A lot of the times when a Dreamcast game is expensive, it's because there's just not a lot of many copies in circulation because people are hanging on to them and playing. So I would say, at least from what I've seen so far, the Dreamcast is one of the most honest pricing libraries, as far as collecting goes. But yeah, it's definitely going to be something that's going to set you back a bit if you decide to collect for the Dreamcast.
It is worth, if you're going to get into playing a Dreamcast, it's worth considering, at least considering, if you think you have the skills, applying a couple of mods to it. We've already mentioned the whole like HDMI thing, and there is things out there where you can improve the machine so it will kind of talk natively in high definition to a computer, to a modern TV. I mentioned earlier about the connecting it to broadband, modern broadband. I don't mean using the... There was a broadband connector which was released for the Dreamcast. It's now very rare and very expensive. Last time I looked, they were somewhere around £200. They were that rare and that difficult to find.
Which is about $350 to $400 American, Yankee listeners.
There you go. But if you have a PC with a serial modem and a virtual machine running Linux, you can set up that PC as what is called a PC-to-DC bridge server, and then your PC acts as a bridge between your Dreamcast and the broadband connection, so the PC handles the heavy lifting. There are various guides online, but do be aware that this is a technical process, so some knowledge of networking is quite useful. Alternatively, there is a device and software called DreamPi. If you Google search DreamPi, P-I, as in the Raspberry Pi, you can buy this, it will do it for you. Okay. The only problem is it is kind of expensive. It's not as expensive as buying a broadband connector, though. But it's worth looking into, or you can buy and modify a Raspberry Pi yourself. So yeah, it's worth looking into.
Yep. And of course, you know, there are all kinds of resources out there if you want to start a Dreamcast collection on, you know, things that can help you build your collection or make it playable on modern televisions. Certainly some YouTube channels that I'd recommend you check out. Metal Jesus Rocks is the big one. There's also Radical Reggie. He does some Dreamcast stuff. Kelsey Lewin, I don't remember exactly what her YouTube channel is, but if you watch any Metal Jesus video where she shows up, she's got a channel where she talks about some stuff that's available. Companies that you might want to look into, Castlemania Games. They're making a bunch of stuff for Dreamcast collectors. And then, of course, you got Pound, who makes those HDMI cables that I've just fallen in love with. If you're looking for something that's non-invasive, don't really want to crack into your console to mod it to make it put an HD output, those HDMI cables that Pound puts out are a nice inexpensive and non-invasive solution. It's definitely you know, if you enjoy retro gaming, a Dreamcast is definitely something worth having in your collection, and its library is definitely something that's worth exploring. We're kind of running short on time here, so let's start wrapping things up. And so I guess the final question we'll ask is, Skyblaze, what to you is the most important thing for larger gaming culture to come out of the Dreamcast?
I think the recognition of online gaming as a thing, and also the recognizing that the culture shift of it away from it being a children's toy towards it being a thing for everyone.
Okay, all right. To me, the most important thing that came out of the Dreamcast is, like I said, it's got to be some of those intellectual properties, those experimental games that came out of the Dreamcast, stuff like, you know, Space Channel 5 or Phantasy Star Online, things that were just huge, hugely impactful to not just game culture, but also to game design. I mean, you mentioned Shenmue, which basically invented the open world RPG. It's just that total paradigm shift that came with the Dreamcast. Like I said, I wasn't kidding when I said that I consider the Dreamcast to be the line in the sand between retro gaming and modern gaming. That was where we went from Old Testament to New Testament, if I may skirt around rule number one for a moment. That was where the rules changed, and that was where gaming changed into basically what we have now. So I mean, that on its own, I think, is why the Dreamcast deserves respect and admiration And I'll tell you what, now I've got kind of a nostalgia kick going. I think I'm going to fire mine up and play some Shenmue and some Episode 1 Racer after we get finished with this.
Okay.
All right.
I'm going to go to bed because it's midnight. But
all right. Well, then that's all the time that we have for A Nerd of the Third Power this week. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. We will see you next week for, well, I don't know what we're doing next week. 2 weeks after that, though, is Avengers. So we'll see you next week for whatever we decide to talk about, and then Avengers Endgame after that. So with that, as always, I'm Dr. Gonzo.
I'm Skyblaze.
We'll see you next week. Taka, play us out.